Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The reactions of world leaders to the death of Fidel Castro include sorrow and sometimes criticism for the former Cuban leader. President Barack Obama reached out to the Cuban people following the death of Fidel Castro to offer his condolences and let them know he will continue his effort to normalize relations with the country. In reaction to Castro's passing, range from sadness to jubilation.
People are celebrating because they see Fidel Castro as a symbol of everything bad that happened to them in Cuba.
Fidel Castro was a very good friend of our former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, and we're very, very sorry to hear of his passing. You know, I hope that we can get to Plaza de Revolucion for a viewing, and my sympathies to the Cuban people.
And Castro's death comes just a couple of years into the thawing of U.S. relations with the island.
Ryan Fonseca of Florida International University spoke with VOA via Skype.
That said, I don't think that his death itself is going to have profound changes in terms of the political evolution in Cuba.
Critics believe there should have been promises from Cuba to improve its human rights record before any changes in U.S. policy were made. President-elect Donald Trump promised during his campaign that he would reverse Obama's executive orders regarding Cuba unless the Castro regime meets U.S. demands.
Those demands will include religious and political freedom for the Cuban people and the freeing of political prisoners.
Cuba observers don't expect much on the island to change in the wake of Fidel Castro's death. Amy Katz, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA News. The Syrian army says it has recaptured a second rebel-held district in eastern Aleppo. Military officials said they have taken full control of the district. It is the second residential area in eastern Aleppo to fall under government control in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, hundreds of people in the war-torn Syrian city of Aleppo are reported to have fled rebel-held areas to districts that are now under government control. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which monitors and reports on the country's nearly six-year civil war, said at least 400 refugees have escaped after government forces recaptured a neighborhood. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has criticized Democrat Hillary Clinton on Sunday for joining an effort to recount votes in three closely contested states that Trump won, recalling that she, during one of their debates, said that election losers should accept the outcome even when they don't like it. In his long campaign, the Republican Trump said the election was rigged against him, but he is calling Green Party nominee Jill Stein's bid to start recounts in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Wisconsin a scam. He derided Clinton's decision to join the effort. Out of millions of votes cast, Trump won all three states over Clinton by about 27,000 votes in Wisconsin, 12,000 in Michigan, and 68,000 in Pennsylvania, with Stein getting about 1% of the vote in each of them. Clinton campaign had not initiated the recount efforts. French conservatives this Sunday choosing their nominee for next year's vital presidential election from among two former prime ministers with deep experience in government and differing views on how to prevent more terror attacks on French soil. The winner of the runoff ultimately could end up facing the far-right National Front leader who is banking on anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, and anti-establishment sentiments. Haji Jean Farkin, a freelance reporter working for Voice of America's Kurdish service, has been released after being detained by Turkish authorities. Details of her arrest Saturday were relayed by a family friend who said that the reason for her detention remained unclear. Her family has said that because of state of emergency declared in the area, even her attorney was not able to contact her. She also freelanced for the BBC and was taken into custody at a police checkpoint while on her way to report on a landslide at a copper mine. The Israeli military says it has killed four gunmen connected with Islamic State-affiliated militants in Syria. The soldiers came under machine gun and mortar attack Sunday on the Israeli side of the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. I'm Tommy McNeil.
The latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
At the gendered environment as it pertains to women parliamentary candidates vis-a-vis the male counterparts.
A group is monitoring the participation of women parliamentary candidates in the upcoming Ghanaian elections.
Requesting to remain anonymous, he said that this is not a one-day campaign, but the beginning of a campaign which will last till the end of the year.
Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo thwart youth protests against President Joseph Kabila.
That sense of unfair treatment of Dr. Riek Machar can actually play into a recruiting drive for people who feel the same across South Sudan, but more especially from people of his own ethnic base.
And an expert warns South Sudan's neighbors that there could be violence if former Affairs Vice President Riek Machar is prevented from returning to the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghanaians go to the polls on December 7th and one will... known organization will be monitoring the performance of women candidates. Margaret Alexander Rehoboth is the head of the Women's Peace and Security Institute at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. She says her group will determine the reasons behind the low percentage of women representing political parties in the parliamentary poll.
What we are trying to do is to track the electoral environment in terms of its responsiveness to gender, i.e. the needs of men and women within the context of the 2016 election. And by that, we're looking at the gendered environment as it pertains to women parliamentary candidates vis-a-vis the male counterpart.
I understand the project that you're undertaking. However, some people are saying that if this is the case, why isn't your group supporting the NDP presidential candidate, former First Lady Nana Akunedo Ajimma-Rawlings, because she is the only female presidential candidate contesting in the presidential election? What do you say to that?
Our focus for this particular program is to see the prospects of women candidates and how that affects their representation in parliament. So that's where our concern primarily is. And we started working on this project long before it became clear that there would be a female presidential candidate. We are just concerned about the women that the different parties, including the party you just mentioned, the women that these parties are fielding as parliamentary candidates, because we are concerned about the numbers of women in our country's parliament. So we won't see how the environment favors or disfavors them, and that's what we're concerned about.
So far that you've done this work, what do you see as the prospect of these women or female parliamentary candidates' performance in the upcoming elections for the parliamentary vote?
It's very difficult to tell. You probably may be aware that the percentage of women in parliament right now is less than 10. The women constitute less than 10% of the parliamentarians as we have right now in the current parliament. We don't know why that is. So what we are doing is to go out there and look at the terrain and see what it is. What are the factors that affect the prospects of women? We can't tell right now what their prospects are. But we are observing, we are just looking at the terrain, and we are hoping that by the time the election is over, we would have been able to observe some patterns that can help us explain why they are absent or why they succeeded or did not succeed. I cannot tell you what their prospects are right now.
Will your group encourage some of these political parties to give support to they are women, or back them more, encourage more women to participate in the parliamentary vote, possibly in the near future?
precisely the reason why, that's one of the key reasons we are embarking on this project. We want to be able to look at the terrain and see how it favors or disfavors women, and then we can make a case and hopefully engage with the leadership of the various political parties to see what kind of policy and action needs to come into place at the political party level, the leadership of the political parties, what kind of actions and policies do they need to have in place in order to improve and increase the prospects of women in successive elections. So this 2016 election is giving us a platform to observe the terrain. And then hopefully the outcome of our observation would inform some policy recommendations or engagements that we hope to have.
What do you say to some Ghanaians who are of the view that cultural and societal pressure could have contributed significantly to the less than 10% of women participation in parliament?
That may be the case. We don't know. I'm saying we don't know because I do not have the empirical evidence right now to tell you that, yes, culture is the reason. There are a lot of assumptions that we make. We also know that Ghana is a fairly patriarchal society, i.e. that men have the advantage when it comes to access to leadership, to high positions. The men are predominantly the ones that occupy the high-level positions and the decision-making positions. That's the case. But whether it is because of that women are not well represented in parliament, I wouldn't be able to say because I do not have the empirical evidence. However, the project we are embarking on, we have been observing the terrain since the 1st of September. We have been looking at the campaign, the electioneering efforts and all of that. And we are hoping that by the time the election itself is over, we would have been able to form a picture of what it is on the ground. And then we can begin to see if we can make some definitive statements about the reasons.
Margaret Alexander Rehoboth is the head of the Women's Peace and Security Institute at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Meanwhile, the Election Day Holiday Movement, comprising a group of young Ghanaian professionals, is calling on the government to declare December 7th a national holiday. This, the group says, will prevent disenfranchising prospective voters who are scheduled to work on the election day and allow them to participate in the voting. Ghanaians go to the polls in a little over a week to choose a new president and parliament. For more about the calls for a holiday for the Ghanaian election, I reach Hans Adutete, a leading member of the movement.
We are pushing the government to declare 7 December as a national holiday due to a whole lot of issues and factors. For example, the first one is being with professionals, those who work in the civil service and those who work in the private organizations. These people work 8 hours in a day, and then the voting starts from 7 to 5 o'clock. So they are also working from 8 to 5. They will not be able to make it from their offices to the workplace to vote and come back to office. Also, they have other responsibilities, which includes family. Some also pick their kids from school and other places, so they will have to juggle between these responsibilities and then go and vote. The second thing is that we have people who want to travel to their hometowns to vote because that is where they registered. Some will have to travel a lot of kilometers, and some also have to travel for 8 hours to vote. I have friends who have to travel from Accra to Sunyani to vote. This is a journey of about 7 hours by road.
Provisions were made by the Electoral Commission to address some of these things. Officials of the Electoral Commission told me this. This is your civic duty. Ghanaians are aware that on December 7th, they were going to go to the polls to choose a new president and a new parliament. Why weren't this factored in by people who are really interested to vote? It's not an all-day affair. People can take some time off from work to go undertake the civic duty. Why a holiday?
It is true that the provisions were made by an electoral commission for people to transfer their votes. But looking at the whole process put down by the electoral commission, it was very cumbersome. It wasn't easy for people to move from workplaces to go and transfer their votes. So it was a whole lot of issues. A lot of people could not transfer their votes. So we are pleading or advocating that 7th December should be made a holiday for those who are not able to transfer their votes. The electoral commission might even attest to the fact that not a lot of people were able to transfer their votes because of the process involved in transferring of votes from various places of registration to their current committee of residence.
Why didn't your group engage the Electoral Commission to include you in the special voting? Why this time, when it's so close to the election, you have less than 3 weeks to the election, and you are now advocating for the government to declare it a national holiday?
Okay, based on that, you talked about the special voting. You know, special voting is for the essential services, which includes the military men, basically the security people. Those are going to take care of security during election day, and then the electoral officers, and then the agents. That's for special voters. Now, when we talk about people who will not vote, just you have to give them the chance. You know, this is a young democracy. This is a very young democracy we are trying to nurture and we are trying to grow. So why don't we give them the chance, the benefit of the doubt, make it a holiday, and then see the voter turnout. Eventually, if you make it a holiday, the voter turnout is going to be very high. A lot of people will have the flexibility of preparing for a journey, moving in, voting, relaxing, and coming back to work the following day. So I think making it a holiday is something which has to be done.
Has your group factored in how much this will cost the nation for declaring a holiday on December 7th?
Yes, we factored it in. You know, every first Friday of December is considered as a Farmers' Day. This time it has been postponed to the 2nd. And we are advocating that making the 2nd of December a holiday, why don't you push it to the 7th? It's the same holiday. So the country will not lose much than making 2nd December just a holiday for farmers, which the activity has already been celebrated. So why don't we push it to the 7th and make the 7th a holiday? And then it will benefit the whole country. You know, we have schools which are being used as polling stations. We have other workplaces which are being used as polling stations. How are students going to concentrate whilst we are voting? How are teachers going to teach whilst we are voting? So let's make the 7th of December a holiday and to enure to the benefit of the whole country.
Hans Adotete is a leading member of the Election Day Holiday Movement. He spoke with me from Koforidua in Ghana's Eastern Region. In the Democratic Republic of Congo on Saturday, youth groups attempted to organize a protest in the Congolese capital. They are urging President Joseph Kabila to stand down at the end of his term in December. For VOA, William Klaus has the latest from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
On Saturday, police in Kinshasa, the Congolese capital, prevented an anti-government demonstration from taking place for the third time this month. The governor of Kinshasa outlawed all political protest in September, in the aftermath of a demonstration during which security forces killed more than 50 people, according to the United Nations. Saturday's gathering was organized by 9 youth groups and was supposed to mark the launch of a new campaign, Bye Bye Kabila, referring to Joseph Kabila, the president of the DRC. They say that Kabila must quit power on December 19th, the end of his second and, under the current constitution, final term. The president, however, intends to remain in office until at least April 2018, and many fear he wishes to alter the constitution to allow him to seek a third term. VOA spoke with an activist of Lucha, a civic engagement group and one of the organizers, about Bye Bye Kabila. Requesting to remain anonymous, he said that this is not a one-day campaign, but the beginning of a campaign which will last till the end of the year. Its purpose, he says, is to ask the Congolese to be vigilant and to demand that the constitution be preserved and respected. The organizers called on their supporters to meet Saturday morning at 6 different places in the city in order to distribute flyers to raise awareness about the Congolese constitution. From early in the morning, it was apparent that the demonstration could not continue as planned. Each meeting place was occupied by pickups full of armed policemen, while trucks of riot police patrolled the roads. Our activity has been obstructed by the large-scale police presence, explained the Lucha activist. To prevent citizens from being able to act freely and from exercising their rights recognized by the Constitution. He says they have been barred from expressing their point of view about the Constitution's violation by President Kabila. Around midday, several dozen activists did burst out of a nightclub on Rond-Point Victoire, one of Kinshasa's busiest roundabouts. For 5 minutes, they shouted anti-Kabila slogans and handed out flyers on which were printed the words of Article 64 of the Constitution. This provision obliges all Congolese to ensure the failure of any individual who takes or maintains power by force or in violation of the Constitution. Most protesters had scattered by the time the police arrived, but according to organizers, one was arrested while another is missing. We have come to accomplish our mission to circulate the message that on December 19th it is the end of President Kabila's mandate, an activist told VOA in the street. If he does not quit power on December 19th, he said, we will apply Article 64. He accused the authorities of being Kabila's accomplices and supporting the regime rather than the Congolese people. The ban on protest has provoked international as well as domestic condemnation. In early November, a group of UN experts unsuccessfully urged the government to revoke the decision, which they called unjustified and disturbing. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Campaigning for the presidential polls continues in the Gambia. Two parties, including a coalition of seven opposition groups, are in the race. They are competing against incumbent President Yahya Jammeh, who is running for a fifth term. All political parties have spent the last 2 weeks crisscrossing the country conversing for votes. Reporter Alpha Jallo has been covering some of the rallies from the Gambian capital, Banjul. Viewer William Eagle asked him about complaints by human rights groups that the government is using intimidation against critics.
So far, only about three people were arrested, two of them working for the state broadcaster Gambia Radio and Television Services, and the other one a freelance journalist working independently according to local newspapers. And both of them violated the Independent Electoral Commission media guidelines. That's all we know as of now.
How have the arrests or intimidation mixed with Jammeh's call for no violence? What type of atmosphere has it created?
Not at all. This has nothing to do with the campaign. The atmosphere is very electric. As you know, that both of the candidates are crisscrossing the country to converse for more votes from the electorate. Although President Jammeh have urged all party militants for a violence-free campaign and polls, he however warned that he will not compromise the security of the country. He also warned those people who want to ignite racist sentiment, they will face the full force of the law.
On what kind of platform are these candidates campaigning?
Yes, the parties all have different campaign platforms. For instance, incumbent president, who is the flag bearer for the Alliance for Patriotic and Reconstruction Party, the APRC, is stressing more on development programs. But he said that he would provide more infrastructural development. He also said in one of his rallies that he will provide free education and healthcare to all Gambians by 2018. As for the flag bearer of the Gambian Democratic Party, Mama Kande, although he's the youngest among the contending candidates, he is saying that he will provide more opportunities for the Gambian youth, and he would also empower Gambian women. He also said that if he's elected, he will fight corruption, because he said that there's a lot of corruption in the country, and that if he is elected on the 4th of December, his main task is also to fight corruption. Flag bearer for the Independent Coalition Alliance, Adama Barrow, he's talking about improving democracy and the rule of law, fighting corruption, and also giving more opportunities to the youth. But in one of his meetings, he said that his first task, if he is elected as president on December 4th, that he will free all political prisoners.
We know that the incumbent, President Yahya Jammeh, is running for a fifth term. Is he popular? And are there any polls that would show his popularity or his base of support?
President Jammeh is very popular, especially from among his ethnic Jola tribe who lives in many villages in the Fonis, that's in the western part of the country. And in most of his rallies, he's been pulling significant crowds. And when he was just coming back from the provinces to the capital, he got a rousing welcome, thousands of party militants and sympathizers throng the highway supporting the president, praising him, chanting his party slogans and saying that he is good for the country because he has brought massive development to the doorsteps of all Gambians. So from what we are seeing on the ground, he is still very popular.
That was reporter Alpha Jallo. He spoke with viewers William Eagle from Banjul. Meanwhile, a South Sudanese legal expert says the move by Ethiopia and Sudan to block former South Sudanese First Vice President Dr. Riek Machar from traveling to South Sudan this weekend will fuel conflict. Remembering Mia Ming is a lecturer at the University of Pretoria's Faculty of Law. He says Sudan and Ethiopia are acting on instructions from senior U.S. government officials. He tells reporter John Tanza that any attempt to sideline the former affairs vice president will complicate the search for peace in South Sudan.
That sense of unfair treatment of Dr. Riek Machar can actually play into a recruiting drive for people who feel the same across South Sudan, but more especially from people of his own ethnic base.
The Sudanese authorities accepted him to stay in Khartoum on medical ground. And then he has also been staying in Ethiopia for quite a long time. In fact, he has a home there in Ethiopia. Why would you think these two countries changed their approach towards Machar?
I can only speculate at the moment, because when John Kerry stood in Nairobi...
You mean the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yes, the U.S. Secretary of State. When he stood in Nairobi and indicated that the replacement of Riek Machar was legal, and then the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, again testifying before the U.S. Congress, said that it was not wise for Dr. Riek Machar to return to South Sudan. What one will make out of that is an American policy position towards South Sudan that want to find a solution to the problem in South Sudan without Dr. Riek Machar.
The message from the international community has always been consistent that the two leaders of the warring parties must end the violence. Now that Machar is facing difficulties getting back to South Sudan, what is the international community doing with President Kiir?
For the first time, I see the region and international community in love with the dictator, because you see that what the action of the region and international community is doing right now is it is emboldened government by ensuring that it is intention of silencing critique, of ensuring that South Sudanese do not speak in Kenya or in Ethiopia or in Uganda. That government that is hunting its citizen is a government that is being supported by the action of these countries in the region and by the international community.
After all that happened to Dr. Riek Machar, my understanding is that he went back to South Africa. What is his legal status now?
My understanding is that the government of South Africa is temporarily hosting Dr. Riek Machar as a visitor while he is there for medical treatment. And that at the end of his treatment, he is supposed to find a place where he will go to, because I do not think that South Africa will be willing and able to host him for a very long time.
And what are the legal implications of this peace agreement? Because the peace agreement was signed between Dr. Riek Machar and the government in Juba and other stakeholders, with one party now sitting on the fence and the others are saying that they are implementing the agreement. What is the legal implication of that?
By isolating the second main party to the agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, what the guarantors of that agreement have communicated to South Sudanese is that agreement is not just dead, it's clinically so. So we do not have a peace agreement at the moment in the absence of the parties that signed that peace agreement.
President Kiir will say he's implementing the peace agreement with Taban Dengai, who is representing the SPLM-IO.
I really cannot deny the government in Juba of their right to self-delusion. They're entitled to their opinion, but as a legal expert and with good knowledge of how peace agreement works, you really cannot sign peace agreement between yourselves, right? Taban Deng is, by all standards, part of the government. How does the government sign an agreement with itself? The agreement is signed with I.O. I.O. under the chairperson of Riek Machar. Riek Machar is not in Juba. His people are not part of the agreement, I mean, of the government of national unity. So how can you be implementing a peace agreement that does not exist in the first place?
Remember, Mia Ming is a lecturer at the Faculty of Law at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He spoke from the Guinean capital, Accra, with reporter John Tanza. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin with the Women's Africa Cup of Nations, where South Africa beat Egypt on Friday to reach the semifinals alongside Cameroon. Banyana Banyana's 5-0 victory made them runners-up to Group A winners Cameroon, who beat Zimbabwe 2-0 also on Friday. And Suwengu Choi hit the opener, South Africa's first goal of the finals, with Nothanando Glakazi, Refila Jen, Jermaine Siopo-Senwe, and Linda Matlaho also on target in an impressive win. Cameroon's victory came courtesy of a brace by Michelle Henrietta Akaba. The indomitable Lionesses, host of the tournament, went into the game assured of their place in the last four and were comfortable against Zimbabwe as they kept up a 100% winning record. In contrast, South Africa knew only a win would take them above Egypt, who started the match in second place with a two-point cushion over their opponents. Cameroon will stay in Yaounde to play the runners-up from Group B. South Africa will stay in Limbe to play the winners of the group. Both semifinals are on Tuesday, November 29th. And in Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has fulfilled his promise and awarded $10,000 to the bulk of national players and officials who helped the team qualify for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon. Earlier this month, while hosting the team at State House, the president had promised to reward each of the players and officials for reaching the Nations Cup after 39 years of waiting. Uganda FA President Moses Magogo confirmed the receipt of the payment, except for six other players and four officials who have not received the payment, despite their account details being sent in. He said the authorities who were handling the payments in the president's office had reduced the numbers. Although President Museveni had promised to give out $15,000 each, the sports ministry clarified that $10,000 had been paid out with an aim to pay out $15,000 in the future to match other nations' rates. Uganda is the only country in the CECAFA region to have qualified for the 2017 Nations Cup. The Cranes are also in the group stages of the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers. And the International Association of Athletics Federation, IAAF, has ratified the following world records. In the women's 3,000 steeplechase, Ruth Jebet of Bahrain is the world's record holder at 8:52.78. She set the record at Paris Saint-Denis on August 27, 2016. The previous record of 8:58.81 was set by Gulnara Galkina of Russia in Beijing. And in the world under-20 records, women's 400-meter hurdles at 54.15 by Sydney McLaughlin of the USA is set at Eugene on July 10, 2016. The previous record had been 54.40 by Wang Xing of China, set at Nanjing on October 21, 2005. And Yomif Kajelshi of Ethiopia now has the men's 3,000 meters at 7:28.19, set at Paris Saint-Denis on August 27, 2016. He broke the previous record of 7:28.78 by Augustine Choge of Kenya, which had been set at Doha on May 13, 2005. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports.
Me, I feel love you long time. Put it on replay for now.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
After you close, you I'll see you again. Well, it took me by surprise. Without you, there'll be no me. What the hell you showed me, girl, looking at you, what I'm seeing is paradise. Kiru, my lover, your beauty in the new movie, I'm gonna leave. A twisty demon, no be, baby, not even you can stop me from loving you. Try it, now I realize you are a blessing in my life. Thank God for giving me you ever since I met you, I go and be like, I'll be there for you. Everywhere you go, I go follow you go, over though you go. Up one moon, I give you in the tomato, one of my one of bimbo, bimbo. For better, for worse, I go marry you. For London to just, I go carry you. My girl, I love your style. If you know how we song, you tell you I'm in love. Come and know me now. Come and show me love. I sleep from this valley. Can't you see that Olua is involved? Come and know me now. Come and show me love. Come celebrate with me, mommy and daddy. Yo. My baby, I like him. Oh, yeah. My baby, I like him.
Like to talk and make it come out for my mind. If I don't want something, I don't go touch and make it clean for my side. So baby, this time today, if I get the cooking pot, this your pot, wait they hot. I like to chop, hot to hot. Oh my God, ask the mud, yellow comfort, all of us, try new talk. Say now you be my disco, miss with calypso, feel the gist in your head. Harrison, go home with sweet. Baby, say you feel the heat. But the feeling in my heart, it makes me say, oh, yeah. My baby, I like. My baby, I like. My baby, I like. My baby, I want to let you know. Yeah, baby, oh, yeah, baby, oh, no, 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 I must meet you, baby, I never.
Chozi, hakuna mwamba Mola unitoke moyoni, ila nusiwezi, nakesha kamlinzi, maana tanki lala unanijia notoni. Asante kwa kuniumiza, umejifunza mengi, mwanzo sikuyajua, na hapa kutolipiza, ila mwambie mapenzi, abaki kuyasikia. Maneno yako utonikimia, utabaki na mimi tena, ukala na viapo taulati bibilia. Leo sikuoni ila mwenzako bado,
bado, bado, bado,
mwambie bado.
Bado, 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 bado,
tanezi kama mbibe mwenzi otamani
choku chansi jesima
masikini penula linandodoka niokote mama
choku chansi jesima.
Triple MG.
Eleo, Emma Naira.
Is Davido.
Celeb pop up on the video. If your body na elele, my body na wire. If my body na elele, I be the one you require. Oh yeah, ele for me, dance it for me. Let them know say that you happy for this. Ele for me, dance it for me. Let them know say your body elele. I could be your supplier. Oh, leo, leo, if your body na wire, then I could be your supplier. Hello, Mr. Wire.
Wire.
What is your heart desire?
Wire.
I'm ready to flex. What is your name? B.I.B. and my Naira. There is no need to holla. I no come for your Naira. Just L.A. for me, L.A. for me. Then I will be your supplier. If your body go, then my body go. It go be like ready go. If your body go, then my body go. It go be like medigo. Oh baby, iguetego, iguetego. If your body na elele, my body na wire. If my body na elele, I be the one you require. Oh yeah, ele for me, that's it for me. Let them know say that you happy for this. Ele for me, that's it for me. Let them know say your body ele. Wire. I could be your supplier. Oh, leo, leo, if your body na wire, then I could be your supplier.
If your body na elele, oh, they got me well, well, well. Bring it back up over, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's getting bigger every, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, shit, come. Baby girl, I don't wanna take chance. Put your love in, break chance. I'll take it to the break chance. Girl, you give me oxygen.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As Cuban Americans whose parents or grandparents fled Cuba celebrated the death of Fidel Castro at 90, thousands of Africans grieved for a man that they perceived as a towering figure of the 20th century. The contrast is understandable. At a time when Fidel Castro was entering Havana in defeat of the dictatorship of Batista, many Africans were struggling to throw out the weight of colonialism and imperialism. And they drew a lot of inspiration for the young commandante. Shortly thereafter, Fidel Castro and his close lieutenant, Che Guevara, began to assist African liberation movements from the north in Algeria to the south of the African continent, including Namibia, Angola, and Mozambique. The icon of the apartheid movement, Nelson Mandela, said it all. When he was criticized for being too close to Fidel Castro, he rejected the accusation and added that it would be an injustice if he had not recognized the profound role played by Fidel Castro and Cuba in the liberation movement in southern Africa. The leaders of Mozambique also acknowledged that a difficult time in the independence movement, Cuban teachers and health workers, as well as military assistance, came in and assisted them. Also, there was something which is not often discussed. In Cuba, there is an island called the Island of Youth, and there are many Africans from the frontline states in southern Africa came in large numbers for their education, and today many of those who were educated in Island of Youth are today the leaders of many of the countries in southern Africa. But the crucial element of Fidel Castro and Cuba occurred in Angola during the terrible civil war, when on one side, Savimbi, the rebel leader, was being supported by Western countries, and on the other side, the government of Angola was being supported by then Soviet Union, Cuba, and many other countries. And when it was reported that South African army has been advised and encouraged by the West to enter the fray in Angola in support of Savimbi, the Russians also convinced the Cuban army to enter Angola to defend the revolution. And in 1987 began the now famous Battle of Quito Carnival. And this series of battles culminated in the defeat of the South African army. This defeat or pushback against the South African army resulted in a revaluation in South Africa. They realized that the apartheid regime could not prevail by military means, and therefore they resorted to negotiations. This made it possible for Namibia to quickly resort to also negotiations for its independence. President Reagan of the United States recognized the importance of the Cuban military in Angola and insisted that Namibia could not become independent until the Cubans leave Angola. And these negotiations succeeded, and the Cubans left Angola and most of Africa. But the Cubans have also continued their humanitarian activities on the African continent. Teachers, medical facilities, they have been everywhere in Africa. And without fanfare, they have been assisting African countries. Recently, when Ebola broke out, the Cuban government sent its health workers, that is to Sierra Leone and Liberia, and tried to help, and they did a commendable job. So for many Africans, Fidel Castro is a towering figure. They are aware, of course, that many consider him to be a dictator in Cuba, but they could only rely on their own personal experience, and therefore they find it sad events that this great leader, in their view, has passed away. You could be certain that many Africans will never forget what Fidel Castro and the Cubans have done, not only to help their liberation, but to ensure that they live a better life. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, the affable Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the leading animal is lame, the herd fails to get to the pasture. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many conflicts worldwide, human trafficking or modern slavery is often among the most tragic consequences. And despite persistent efforts to eradicate trafficking in persons, this abhorrent crime persists. According to the International Labor Organization, over 20 million people worldwide are victims of forced labor. On September 16th, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations and December President of the Security Council, Samantha Power, stated that for groups like ISIL and Boko Haram, slavery has become one of their most versatile weapons of war, used to instill fear, to inflict suffering, to recruit followers, reward fighters, convert people of other faiths, reward combatants, and generate revenue. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL distributes women and girls to fighters as spoils of war, systematically rapes them, and sells them in markets like cattle. ISIL has even gone so far as to encourage the sexual assault of prepubescent girls and issue guidelines on how to treat the women and girls who have been enslaved. Boko Haram also exacts horrors upon those whom it has kidnapped and enslaved. On October 2nd, the group reportedly forced four girls and a boy to become suicide bombers in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, where they self-detonated at a mosque during evening prayers. 15 people, including these kids, were killed, and more than 35 were injured. Witnesses estimated that the bombers were as young as 9 years old. Member states must commit to ending the conflicts that enable human traffickers to operate, as well as support trafficking victims. To address this in Iraq and Syria, where ISIL has enshrined systems of human trafficking and sexual violence, the U.S.-led 65-member coalition remains determined to destroy ISIL, stem the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, and restrict its funding streams used to fuel its reign of terror. The U.S. also continues to provide security and counterterrorism assistance to the governments of Chad, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin to aid their fight against Boko Haram. Human trafficking in conflict is a scourge that knows no borders. That's why U.N. member states must individually combat human trafficking and coordinate efforts now to put a stop to this human tragedy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Yeah.